Parshas Kisisa opens with the mitzvah of Machtes HaShekel. As we know, it's the yearly giving of the half shekel. This is an actual half shekel, which is worth money. And that money is used for purchasing the year's korbanos, the communal offerings. And this yearly contribution of the Machtes HaShekel is, not surprisingly, a mitzvah of Taryag. The Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, Mitzvahs Asei Kuf Ein Aleph. It's a positive mitzvah, 171. Reads, Shetzivanu Laseis Machtes HaShekel B'chol Shana. There's a mitzvah to give a Machtes HaShekel, a half the shekel every year. V'hu Amar Yis'ale. And what is the source for this? The Psukim, as we know, V'nosnu ish kofer nafshe l'Hashem. Each person should give his kofer nefesh, his ransom for his soul. V'omar, and it states additionally in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Ze yitnu kol ha'over al ha'pikud. This they shall give the machzis ha'shekel. And therefore, the Rambam is on record here codifying the mitzvah of Machtes HaShekel as one of the Taryag mitzvahs. And as we said, not surprisingly, looks like a mitzvah, reads like a mitzvah, it's a mitzvah. Interestingly, not all Rishonim list the Machtes HaShekel in Taryag. And there are many as what are known as Moneh HaMitzvahs, those that list the mitzvahs. It's a whole literature, it's a whole study. The Uraim, Rabbeinu Eliezer Mimetz, one of the great Rishonim of France, does not list Machtes HaShekel in his count, even though he fully subscribes to the halacha that there is a mitzvah to give a Machtes HaShekel every year. If there's a mitzvah, why is it not a mitzvah? And Rav Asher Weiss suggests that perhaps the reasoning of the Uraim, who doesn't list the Machtes HaShekel as a mitzvah, is because the money from the Machtes HaShekel is used towards the korbanos, right, the korban tzibur, as we mentioned. As such, perhaps the Uraim understands that this is purely feeding into the bringing of the korbanos, and as such it represents an adjunct or a preparation for the korbanos and is part of that general mitzvah. As we know, mitzvahs can sometimes have details and they can sometimes have lead-ins. Therefore, for the Uraim, there's so many things that are involved in bringing a korban, and one of them is funding them. But it's part of the mitzvah of korban and therefore not an independent mitzvah of taryag. That's a very interesting perspective. Korbanos are a mitzvah. The Machtes HaShekel is what we call a hechsher mitzvah. It allows for an enabling act, but not necessarily the mitzvah itself. And then Rav Asher Weiss has a fascinating additional comment. There is support that may be adduced for the Rambam's position, and again, it's now machlokus rishonim. Is it a mitzvah of taryag or not? Rambam lists it. Uraim doesn't. Support for the Rambam can come from the Mishnayos. Now, what does that mean, that support can come from the Mishnayos? Well, normally, when you say that, you need to identify which Mishnah you mean. Here, however, support for the Rambam comes from an entire Masechta of Mishnayos. How so? Because Machtes HaShekel forms the basis of a Masechta of Mishnayos called Shkolim. Okay, like everything else, you need to know its halachas. Well, where is Shekalim? As we know, of the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, one of the orders of the Mishnah is called Moed. It deals with Moedim. It deals with things that happen every week or every year. All the Yomim Tovim are in Seder Moed. There's another order which is called Seder Kochim. It's all the halachas of korbanos. So there you have two sedarim. We've abridged somewhat. But there's moed and there's kochim. So let's ask a shayla. Where is Masechta Shkalim? And the answer is, it's in Seder Moed. Now, according to the Uraim, if the subtotal of the mitzvah of bringing the machzis hashekel is to fund the korbanos, and it's actually a branch of the mitzvah of korbanos, would it not have been more appropriate for Masechta Shekalim to be in Seder Kodshim, which is where the halachos of korbanos are discussed? Rather, we see that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and as he arranged the Mishnayos, he put it in Seder Moed as if to indicate that there is an independent obligation every year. It will fund the korbanos. That's what that will come from it. But it's its own mitzvah, and it's every year, and thus it finds itself in Seder Moed. It's very rare that you're able to get a lock on a mitzvah in that way from seeing where in the Mishnayos it is. And indeed, the Rambam, not surprisingly, also discusses the halachas of Machzis HaShekel in his volume dealing with Yomim Tovim, which he doesn't call Moed, but calls Sefer HaZmanim. So that's a very interesting comment of Rav Asher Weiss on this Machlokas Rishon. I'd like to add a little more, because if we go back to the words of the Rambam, we note, again, in his Sefer HaMitzvah, Shetzivanu Lasis Machzis HaShekel B'chol Shana. There's a mitzvah to give Machzis HaShekel every year. And what is the source? He quotes the pasuk, which, if we see it in the Chumash here, it's really the second pasuk. Pasuk Yud Beis of Perek Lamed. Ki sisa es rosh b'nei Yisrael of Kodem, v'nosnu ishko fenafshu l'Hashem, b'kodosam. That's the first pasuk, to give the Machzis HaShekel. And the Rambam then quotes the following pasuk, ze yitnu. Now, the very delicate question here is, firstly, I do not believe the Rambam ever quotes two psukim for one mitzvah. Generally speaking, one mitzvah is enough. If there's two mitzvahs, there's normally two psukim, there's two mitzvahs. That being the case, why does the Rambam see it as relevant or necessary to quote both Pasuk Yud Beis and Pasuk Yud Gimel for the very same mitzvah? That's an interesting shaila. And I think that perhaps the answer to this question will actually take us deeper into these psukim, because we have made something of a presumption with regards to these psukim. But you see how, on the one hand, there's the parsha and there's the psukim, and see how the mitzvahs come out. You see, in context, the Machzis HaShekel, as you find it in Parshas Kisisa, seems to have nothing to do with what we call the mitzvah of Machzis HaShekel. As if to say, we know that what is the yearly Machzis HaShekel for? It's to buy the korbanos of the tzibur. Where does this all come from? The beginning of Kisisa. Look in the beginning of Kisisa, you will find no mention of korbanos tzibur. What you will find mention of is how to take a census, how to count the Jewish people. Kisisa is Rosh B'nai Yisrael. When you wish to have a reckoning of the number of B'nai Yisrael, here's the way to do it. Do not count them directly, rather take a ransom. And what should that ransom be? It should be the Machzis HaShekel, which means it sounds like we're not so much dealing with a requirement, a standing requirement to fund the korbanos, but rather the approved method of counting the Jewish people. Now, there is no mitzvah to count the Jewish people every year. If anything, it could be possibly problematic. And that being the case, how are we able, in a sense, to draw out from the context of counting the Jewish people, which is not an ongoing mitzvah, Machzis HaShekel, and see it as, yes, an ongoing mitzvah? That is the question. That's the methodology of deriving a mitzvah where the context doesn't seem to be talking about that mitzvah at all. And I believe that is why the Rambam, as he often does in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, if he feels it necessary, he'll explain not only what the mitzvah is, but why he considers it to be a mitzvah. Sometimes it's not so obvious, and the Rambam will write more at length. Here, the Rambam demonstrates why he considers this to be a mitzvah by quoting both of these psukim, as if to say, if all there was to the Machzis HaShekel is the contextual, the way to count the Jewish people, then the pasuk, the Torah, need not have devoted two psukim to the Machzis HaShekel. It could very simply have said, if we look at pasuk Yud Beis, Kisisa es Rosh B'nai Yisrael Lifgudeim, when you wish to count the Jewish people, V'nosnu ish kofer nafsho, and each person should give a ransom for his soul, Machtzis ha-shekel b'shekel ha-kodesh. Put the whole thing into one pasuk. It's, if all you're saying is one thing, then you can say it in one pasuk. When you want to count, let them give a kofer nefesh, which is called Machtzis ha-shekel. But that's why the Rambam is drawing our attention to the fact that the Torah did not compact all this into one pasuk. And the reason why is because there are two things going on here. There are two dynamics. On the one hand, first and foremost, in terms of the context, it's about counting the Jewish people, as the first pasuk states. When you want to count, they should give a kofer nefesh, and that's that. The next pasuk, it almost sounds like it starts again. Ze yitnu. This is what they should give. And the reason why it's its own pasuk, says Rambam, is because it is actually the source of its own mitzvah. There is an independent requirement to give the Machtzis HaShekel, even if you're not counting the Jewish people. That's the mitzvah of Machtzis HaShekel, which is the yearly mitzvah. So this is why the Rambam brings both psukim, and indeed the Sefer HaChinuch, who follows the Rambam often very closely, only quotes the second pasuk as the source. And perhaps we can understand why. Why did he pass over the opportunity for the first pasuk? Perhaps for the very same reason. The first pasuk is not about the yearly mitzvah. The first pasuk is about counting the Jewish people. But if we're looking for the source for the yearly mitzvah, it's the reiteration in pasuk Yud Gimel of Ze Yitnu. So these...
The fact that it's a special parasha, the Shabbat Shkalim, with its own reading of this piece, but that again, not... be a source to assign it its own status, that we wouldn't give that to a Heksha Mitzvah. It would be a special maftir for a Heksha Mitzvah.
True, but that itself needs, in other words, so the question will be, Chazal themselves, how do they know it's a mitzvah? So in the end, you'll need to take it back to the Pasuk.
I'm not going to ask him, Ray Yerain, why would he say there's a special Shabbos for Pasuk
Shabbos? Ah, okay. Yeah. Good question. Good. Okay. Let's move deeper now into the Parsha and get to the section of the Chet HaEgel. And specifically, I want to talk about Moshe's tfilos at the time of the Egel. And as we'll see, there is a major discussion amongst Rishonim, and it will take us into very basic matters of Parshanut. Let's find the place in the Psukim in Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Zion. And this is already where Moshe is being informed by Yidaber Hashem and Moshe Lechred, go down, Shiches Amcha, they've made the Egel, and over the next three or four Psukim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe what's happened with the Egel, and the Jewish people are in grave danger. Now, let's follow the next psukim carefully. One could divide the next group of psukim into three in the following way. Psukim Yud Aleph to Yud Dalet are psukim of which describe tefillah, beginning with Vayichal, Vayichal Moshe. It's the laning for a fast day. The psukim are well known. And you have four psukim of tefillah. Okay, that's segment one. Segment two, it then describes Moshe as he goes down and sees what he sees and does what he does and deals with the people to a certain extent and administers even the punishment in to some degree. The confronting the eagle. Pasuk Lamed, picking up after that second segment, Pasuk Lamed to Lamed Hey, are psukim of tefillah again. But Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayoshev Moshe Lashem Vayomar, Ana Chata Amazechata Gedola, and he starts davening for them. So essentially, to summarize the sequence of the psukim here, we have some psukim of tefillah, then dealing with the egel, and then some more psukim of tefillah. Okay, that's Parshas Kisisa. Now, what makes the matter somewhat more intriguing is that the episode with the Egel is retold by Moshe in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Ekev. And if you look there in Parshas Ekev, and this is going to be in Perek Tes, Moshe describes what happens with the Egel, and then he describes the tefillos that he offered to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on behalf of the Jewish people. Therefore, we have two different sequences between Kisisa and Devarim. Kisisa gives us tefillah, dealing with the Egel, and more tefillah, whereas Parshas Ekev in Sefer Devarim gives us the Egel and then tefillah. Which leads us to the question, when did actually Moshe offer these tefillahs? Is the sequence to be understood as is in our Parsha? And if so, why does Parshas Ekev give a different version, different sequence? Or if the correct sequence is as it was in Ekev, then why does our Parsha give a different sequence? But they cannot be both before and after, and only after. Those are mutually exclusive. Which then is the way to understand these psukim? This question is discussed and debated by no less than the Ibn Ezra and Ramban. Does not get heavier than Ibn Ezra and Ramban. And let's begin with Ibn Ezra. Says Ibn Ezra, the way I understand the psukim is that the order was sequentially, chronologically, as is portrayed in Chumash Devarim. First Moshe deals with the Egel, and then he davens. And why do I say that? Says Ibn Ezra. Because I find it inconceivable that if the people are involved in the Egel, that Moshe can be doing anything other than dealing with the Egel. Because until it's been dealt with, you can't then start davening about it. And therefore, says Ibn Ezra, the tzav hasha'ah, right, the critical, time-sensitive priority is to go and eradicate what's going on with the Egel. Once you've done that, so then you can start to talk about kapara. You can't ask for kapara when the thing is still going on. And therefore, if you wish to know the sequence of events, Moshe first deals with it and then starts to daven, as Parshas Ekev indicates. Now, of course, that leaves us with a Parshas Kisisa question. Namely, if he didn't daven until afterwards, why are there some psukim of tefillah already mentioned before the Torah describes him going down? What we refer to as psukim Yud Aleph and Yud Dalet. Says Ibn Ezra, the reason why there are already psukim of tefillah mentioned at this early stage, even though Moshe didn't daven yet at this early stage, is because there is a thematic link between Hashem's words and Moshe's tefillah. Namely, Moshe's not ready to daven, not until he deals with the Egel, but he's already been told that he can daven. He's already been told that if he davens, it will help. The time is not yet, but the message has been given. And where was that message given? In Hashem's words to Moshe, in Pasuk Yud, Hashem says to Moshe, Ve'ata hanichali, leave me alone, v'yichar api bohem, and I will be angry at them, v'achalei. And the Gemara says an amazing thing, and Rashi even quotes it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in saying to Moshe, leave me alone, and I will get angry at them and destroy them. Essentially what he's saying is, if you leave me alone, that's what will happen. So that means, maybe you shouldn't leave me alone if you don't want it to happen. It's an amazing thing. Hashem says to Moshe, hanichali. Interestingly, just parenthetically, but it's an important Lashon HaKodesh point. There are two words in Lashon HaKodesh. They are pronounced almost identically, and they have practically the opposite meaning. And they are the word lehaniach and lehaniach. One's with the patach, one's with the komatz. So depending on who you are, you may pronounce those two differently. That's the concept of minding your P's and Q's, your patachs and your komatzes. But the difference between them is, as we see here, hanichali means leave me alone, to forsake or to abandon. That's lehaniach with a patach. Lehaniach is to place something. It can make a big difference in the morning when a person makes a bracha on his tefillin, lehaniach tefillin. because if he's Ashkenazi, he intends to make a difference between the two, and says lahaniyat tefillin, he's made a bracha to abandon tefillin, which is arguably inappropriate, and therefore you see the correct pronunciation makes a big difference. In any case, that's the bracha. There's lehoniach and so on and so forth. Back here again, Hashem says hanichali, and this is Hashem's signal to Moshe. When the time is right, you should daven, because if you don't, I'm going to get angry at them and destroy them. You should know that already. And because this is the place where Moshe is told that tefillah can work, we already have almost what you could call a preview or some representation of some of his tefillah, even though it was not actually uttered until that point. And here we see that the tefillah is divided into two, because we're given a first taste of the tefillah, so to speak, when Moshe is told that he can daven, and then the rest as it relates to events after the Egel, just the aftermath of the Egel, Moshe is davening for them. But in reality, none of this tefillah actually occurred until afterwards, as is set forth in Parshas Ekev, where all you have is the Egel first, and then you have all the tefillah. That represents the actual sequence. And here it's not so much the chronological sequence, but it's more the thematic connections. And here, Ibn Ezra shows himself once again to be actually the most liberal in his application of the concept of Ein Mukdam Umu'uchar Batorah. Ein Mukdam Umu'uchar Batorah means the Torah's presentation, the order of presentation of Parshios, is not always the same as the sequential order of those events. It can deviate sometimes. But the question is, how many times? Is that the exception? Is it common? Is it uncommon? And the Ibn Ezra really is the one who applies this most of all. You see here is a classic example that this tefillah hadn't happened yet. But you see, Hashem had told him about davening. It's already appropriate to talk about it. It hadn't happened. These thematic links really are used very widely by the Ibn Ezra. Well, that's his approach. And again, to summarize, sequentially, it's like Parshas Ekev. First was the practicalities of dealing with the Egel, then came the Tefillah. Thematically, in our Parsha, he was told about Tefillah, so we hear a bit about his Tefillah, and then we hear some more, the rest of it, after he deals with the Egel. Not in keeping with the chronological sequence of events. Who will argue with Ibn Ezra over a matter like this, if not Ramban? Ramban, and again, in keeping with Ramban's approach to Ein Mukdam Umu'uchar Batorah, who is of the most conservative and of the most sparing. By the time you get to use Ein Mukdam Umu'uchar Batorah, according to Ramban, you could count the cases probably on the fingers of one hand and have some to spare. And as Ramban, he has such a resistance to it in his words, as he refers in Parshas Korach, "V'lamana poch divrei Elokim chayim." Why should we rearrange Hashem's words? He's aware of the concept, but it's only to be used in, I would say, in case of emergency. And here, therefore, says Ramban, the order is as the Torah presents it. As soon as Moshe is told about what's happened, he begins to daven. Then he deals with it and comes back and davens some more. And should you ask, well, why does he divide his davening up into two? Says Ramban, very simply, because the first thing he was told is if he doesn't daven, Hashem will destroy the Jewish people. If you don't do something about that, there's not going to be that much left to deal with. And therefore, one could almost say that the critical requirement, the paramount requirement at that time, is just to hold off from what was being presented as the destruction of the Jewish people. One can't say, well, I have to deal with them first, even though I've just been told they're about to be destroyed. You need to deal with that first. And then at the very least, buy them some time, go and deal with the people, and then come back and finish off the tefillah. And Ramban says, support for my position is in the Medrash Rabbah, in Shmos Rabbah. Now, in matters of pshat, such as these, it's very interesting that the Ramban adduces proof from the Medrash Rabbah. After all, the Medrash Rabbah is not always al derech hapshat. And the Ramban himself often explains the pshat not in accordance with the Medrash Rabbah. However, if the Ramban, in any case, argues with Ibn Ezra and the Midrash is on his side, it certainly corroborates. Amar Moshe, says the Shmos Rabbah, Imaniach ani es Yisrael, if I leave the Jewish people, ve'ered, mean if I leave their cause and just go down to them, ein Yisrael tekuma ba'olam, they will have no existence. Aval ein izaz mikan achavakesh aleihem rachamim, I cannot leave this point until, this place, until I ask for mercy from them. Miyad hiskel Moshe lelama deleim senegoria, and Moshe begins to plead their cause. So the Medrash Rabbah states explicitly that Moshe, at least that opening segment of the tefillah, was stated at that time in order just to deal with the life or death situation for the Jewish people. then other matters could be dealt with later on. So, which means that the correct sequence of events, says Ramban, is to be understood as the one that is portrayed in our parsha. Of course, the question will now be, if that's the correct sequence, so then why does Parshas Ekev not mention the opening tefillah? And why does Parshas Ekev just mention the tefillahs at the end? That seems to be the aberration from the sequence. Well, says Ramban, to understand why Sefer Devarim doesn't present the exact sequential order here, you need to remember what Sefer Devarim is for. Sefer Devarim isn't to tell us what happened, because we know that already. Sefer Devarim is Moshe's words of rebuke and of chastisement and of instruction to the Jewish people about those events, and therefore the way that things will be presented is geared and orientated in as such, which means that Moshe's his priority when telling them about the Chet HaEgel is to discuss their role. The fact that he davened to help them is it's part of the story, but it's certainly not the primary part of the story looking back in terms of lessons learned, because the lessons learned should not be whatever happens, Moshe will get you out of it. The lessons learned is don't do that again. And therefore, the emphasis is fully primarily on the role of what the Bnei Israel did. And after that's been done, then Moshe comes back to talk about his tefillos. So as we said, classic parshanut, you see the two parshas, Kisisa and Ekev, that discrepancy to understand which one represents what and why and how to explain the other one. And that's Ramban and Ibn Ezra. Now, I'd like to actually look at one or two aspects within the tefillah of Moshe, the tefillah of Vayichal, which, as we said, is in Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Now, as we said, the Moshe knows to daven because Hashem told him to leave him alone. It's a very interesting to read between the lines almost. Sometimes the way someone says to leave them alone is basically saying that you got to do something. And that's why he started to daven. But there is a further comment which is made by one of the great Sephardi Rishonim, the Tzvor Hamor. The Tzvor Hamor, Rabbi Avram Seba, who was actually one of those that was expelled from Spain, and when he left Spain, he took his sefer with him, Tzvor Hamor. I don't know if it was called that at that time. He had a sefer on the Chumash, and he was told to leave it behind. They couldn't leave as Jews. It was the way that he had to get out. They could have nothing on them that identified them as Jews, and he buried it under a tree, the sefer that he had. If everyone one day he would come back just as like a landmark, and he could never get back into Spain. And his sefer's there, and he's there, and the two could never be reunited again. and he rewrote his sefer from memory. And that's the Tzvor Hamor. Anyway, a very special sefer. And he draws our attention just to another, one could almost say it's like an atmospheric marker within these psukim. Because Hashem's report to Moshe, so to speak, begins in Pasuk Zion. Let's have a look in Pasuk Zion, Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Zion. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe, Lech Wait, go down. Shichezemcha, your people, they've acted destructively. Saru Maher Min HaDerech, they've departed swiftly from the path that they made an Egel. And they've Pasuk Tes, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Ra'isi. I've seen these people. They're a They're stubborn people. Vata nichali, and this is the pasuk that we just saw a moment ago. Leave me be. If you're angry with them, I'll destroy them. I'll make you a great nation. Those are the four psukim whereby Moshe is appraised of what's happened with Ahikam. And the Tzor HaMor asks a very interesting shaila. Namely, look at the beginning of pasuk Tes. This is one communication. And it begins in Pasuk Zayin with the words, Vayidaber Hashem and Moshe. Hashem spoke to Moshe and said the following. And what did he say? Well, he said a number of things. They made the Egel. They're a stubborn people. I'm going to destroy them. That's all in that message. Generally speaking, if there are a number of things, they're all covered by the opening words that he said the following. And then you have the words. If Pasuk Zayin opens with Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe, and we already have our messages. So why does Pasuk Tes start again? Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. He's in the middle of talking. But it sounds like he's starting from the beginning again. But he isn't. He's just keeping going. So how do you have four psukim of Hashem speaking to Moshe with two openers? One Vayidaber Hashem and one Vayomer Hashem. Says the Tzor HaMor, as we know, not only does the Torah repeat, but it changes the term. In Pasuk Zayin, it says, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe. In Pasuk Tes, it says, Vayomer Hashem Moshe. Well, what's the difference? Aren't they two ways of saying the same thing? But as we know from the Gemara in Makkos and Daf Yud, Rashi quotes it in a number of places, there is a difference between the term Dibur and Amira. Dibur is Lashon Kasha. Dibur is harsh. Amira is Lashon Raka. It's softer. It's more encouraging. Okay, says the Tzor HaMor, now you see. Why is there a new marker for Hashem speaking to Moshe? Because the tone changed. The way that he spoke to him changed. The first two psukim are very harsh. Understandably so. They made the egel. Nothing much else to say. And with that tone, Moshe's not going to say anything. You hear about the egel, it's not, you don't know what to say? You should probably say nothing. So then what happens? Shem starts again. And this time, softer. It's amazing. Because very often, even a criticism, but if it's said in a softer way, it's a form of encouragement. And that way, I mean, what's the message? The message is, they're a stubborn people. I'm going to destroy them. But how do you say that nicely? But how do you say that softly? How do you say that in an encouraging way? But you can. And really what it means is, as soon as Hashem says to Moshe, so to speak, but as soon as Hashem says to Moshe in that way, you know, they're a stubborn people. But it's a friendly thing. Sometimes when something is an absolute disaster, but you say it in that way, really the underlying message is, so what are we going to do about it? How are we going to help the situation? You know, I'm practically thinking of just destroying them. But if you say that nicely, what you're saying is, it's a serious business here. But the tone is softened because there's what to work with. And you have a role here. That's the point when Moshe realizes it's time to daven. If we've gone from two psukim of Dibur to two psukim of Amira, that's Moshe's cue to start davening for them. And what does he say? So the famous Vayichal. And it's interesting because the first pasuk, it's very easy to identify with it emotionally without ever looking at it. And seeing that it doesn't seem to be such a meaningful plea at all. What does Hashem say to him? Vayichal Moshe, es p'nei Hashem elokav. Moshe entreats Hashem. It's interesting to imagine, even for a moment, what we would expect the next words to be if it's an entreaty. But it's a question, and it's almost like a rhetorical question. We know the words. Lama Hashem yecharab chabamecha. Why are you getting angry at them? Sheretzesom eretz Mitzrayim b'chor gadol v'yad chazakah. He took out of Mitzrayim with great strength. And it's a very interesting question. In fact, it's practically impossible to understand. The answer is quite simple, and it's really what the whole situation is about. Why is Hashem angry at them? Because they made the egel hazav. I mean, that's the answer, if you're asking. So how is this a tefillah for them? But that's not a tefillah. I mean, that's It's a very straightforward question, which has an equally straightforward answer, and then you're back to square one. Says the Abarbanel, to understand why this first pasuk is a plea on their behalf, we have to go to the final words in the pasuk. Again, Lama Hashem, or Lama Hashem, more correctly, Yechere Abcha Ba'amecha, you'll be angry with them. Asher Tzeis Hamer Tzutam, you took about a Mitzrayim, Bechoach Gadol Uv Yad Chazaka. What is the meaning of Koach Gadol and Yad Chazaka? And Yad Chazaka is a term that we find a number of places throughout the Torah, and we're familiar with it, but it's very easy not to ever ask what it actually means. Strong hand, outstretched arm, they keep each other company, but what do they mean? And here says Abarbanel, the concept of Yad Chazaka, and it's something of a chiddush, but many Mefarshim say this, Yad Chazaka is Hashem's strong hand, which was displayed against the Jewish people in taking them out. Yad Chazaka, they were strong-handed out of Mitzrayim. And what does that mean? We know what it means. We know that many of them didn't want to leave. Even the ones that got away are ready to go back at any time. And what that means is that they felt a certain affinity. They felt a certain connection with what was going on in Mitzrayim, with all of its difficulties. Imagine, I mean, they must have, because as difficult as it was, but they still want to go back at every juncture, where at every point of uncertainty. How can it be? Because let us say culturally or behaviorally, they developed a certain sympathy with that. And that's why some of them didn't want to leave. Even as deep in as Makas Choshech, which is number 9, where they clearly realize that they're on the winning side and Egypt is on the losing side. And now the question is, are you ready to leave? And they say, no, we like it here. This is our home. 4/5 of them didn't leave. That's Yad Chazaka. And indeed, and in this respect, the Netziv, in his commentary to the Haggadah, and I believe also that Aruch HaShulchan, in his commentary to the Haggadah, there's a famous section, because we say in Magid, Hashem took us out with Yad Chazaka. And as we know, at that stage, we give explanatory words and phrases to each of those original words, and labels. And what do we say about Yad Chazaka? Zuhadever. That's what it says. Yad Chazaka Zuhadever. Zeru Natuya is Cherev. Right? These are the later portions. They weren't Zohar to as much commentary as the earlier portions. Some people are still on the four sons at that stage, but the Haggadah keeps going. And that's really the heart of Magid, really those drushes. What's Yad Chazaka? Zuhadever. That's Dever, pestilence. And the question is, if when they borrow the phrase, if you've got 10 plagues, and that's number 5, Ma nishtana makazos mikola makos. I mean, of all the 10, why is that one, why is that Yad Chazaka? I mean, the number 4 was also Yad Chazaka, so it was number 6, and so were all the others. And there's many answers to this question. But the Netziv gives a very different approach to all of this. And that is that the Dever in question here is not Makkah number 5 that was brought against the Paro. I mean, all Makkahs are equal in that respect. There was another Dever, there was another plague that took place in Egypt. The plague that happened during the 3 days of darkness, where all the Jews that refused to leave were killed. That's the Dever that we're referring to, because that's an expression of the Yad Chazaka that we're talking about. There's such resistance to leaving in spite of everything, such a kind of an affinity with the land of Egypt, that's called Yad Chazaka. And even those that were taken out by Yad Chazaka. But what does this mean? They had to leave, right? The time had come, we had to leave. But because we hadn't fully, to say the least, hadn't fully shaken off the influence of Mitzrayim, that is why Moshe pleads on behalf of the Jewish people that, why are you angry at them? Don't forget that you took them out, but you took them out b'yad chazaka. That means that they're very invested and they're very enmeshed and admired with what was going on in Mitzrayim. And that's what found its expression in the Egel Hazav, as if to say, this is Moshe's defense for the Jewish people. If they of their own initiative had made the Egel, that would be unforgivable. But it's not them. They're still. It's the product of those influences. You see that you have to take them out beyond Chazaka. I mean, they just haven't fully left Mitzrayim yet.
blame to Hashem. It's ascribing the blame to Hashem for the strong hanging them out.
The alternative is the dissolution of the Jewish people. Yeah, but sometimes it happens. In fact, according to this, it's interesting just to ponder the implications here, because really what Moshe is saying is that the Jewish people, even though they left Mitzrayim physically, because they couldn't stay there anymore, shall we say, emotionally or culturally, had never fully left. But that, I think, gives new insight into the next section that follows, namely the recovery from the Chet HaEgel, which takes place over these next very serious 40 days, and the davening, and then the final section of 40 days, and the fundamental rehabilitation from the Chet HaEgel comes on Yom Kippur. And I wonder if it's possible to say that from that point of view, Yom Kippur represents a supplementary stage in what you could call Yitzias Mitzrayim. It's very interesting. Mefarshim raised the question. We say that all the Yomim Tovim are Zecher Yitzias Mitzrayim. Some of them are easier to understand than others. Shavuos, what happened when we left Mitzrayim, and Sukkot, etc. We say Yom Kippur is Zecher Yitzias Mitzrayim. From a certain point of view, it could be that Yom Kippur is Zecher Yitzias Mitzrayim, because Yom Kippur was actually a significant stage in Yitzias Mitzrayim. Because fundamentally, being able to shed the effects of the Egel, which was a product of not having fully left Mitzrayim, that happens on Yom Kippur. Could be. So Moshe davens for Bnei Yisrael, and things are not annulled completely. The decree against them is not annulled completely, but certainly fundamentally, and the Jewish people are they remain and they continue. And as part of the being told about the forgiveness of the Jewish people, Moshe receives what are known as the Yud Gimel Midosh HaRachamim, the 13 attributes of mercy. And let's have a look at them in Perek Lamed Dalet, Pasuk Vav. Again, the psukim we know, Vayavar Hashem apanav, Vayikra Hashem passed by him, and he called Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum Vechan. And I'd like to focus for the next few moments on one of the midos, for as we'll see, there is a certain clarification that is required, namely the midah of Kel, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum Vechanim. What is the connotation of Kael? Rashi comments. Rashi says, Kael avzu midas rachamim. This is also midas rachamim. Of course, Hashem Hashem is a name of rachamim. Hashem Hashem. And then Kael, says Rashi, is also a name of rachamim. And he supports this idea from a pasuk, V'cheinu Omer, Keili Keili lama azavtani, which is the pasuk that we referred to last week. And Rashi says, if it's a harsh measure, no one ever complains if that goes missing. So you never say that. So if you're forsaken and you wonder, well, where did it go, and you'd like it back, that means it's a benign thing. It's midas harachamim. Kach matzasi b'mechilta. Thus I found in the mechilta. It's an interesting expression of Rashi. Kach matzasi b'mechilta. How did he find it in the Mechilta? Because he knows the Mechilta, because he quotes the Mechilta the whole time. I don't think Rashi normally uses that expression, I found in the Mechilta. He'll say, Kach shenuya b'mechilta. That's what the Mechilta says. Interestingly, and I'm not sure if this is connected, if you look in the Mechilta, it actually quotes other psukim also to demonstrate that Kael is a midah of rachamim, is a midah of kindness or compassion. Kael na rafanala, which is Moshe's words of tefillah for Miriam. Kael Hashem vaya'er lanu isuchat v'avosim. So the Mechilta actually quotes more, but so be it. And that is that. Now, interestingly, that's all Rashi has to say. And why is that of significance? Because Rashi, as the Mizrahi points out, Rashi doesn't then tell us how this midah of Kael is different than any of the other midahs, which is an also question, because if there's 13 midahs, presumably they're different from each other. How are they different? Rashi doesn't discuss that. Which means that from that point of view, Rashi feels that it's enough to leave us to understand that there's different levels of kindness or whatever it would be. Rashi's priority is only to establish that these are terms of kindness or positive terms. Once that's happened, then Rashi's job is done, al derech hapshat, even though there's more to be said. How exactly what does each one express itself? However, there is a further insight into the name Kael, which is to be found in one of the later Mefarshi Rashi, the Divrei David of the Taz, Reb David HaLevi. And he explains that actually, at heart, the word Kael doesn't mean kindness and doesn't mean compassion. It means strength. There is a term in Eilei Ha'aretz, in Divrei Hayom, Eilei Ha'aretz, people that are strong. And Rashi himself says in Divrei Hayomim, that Eil means strong. Now, if Eil means strong, and it's used as a midah of Rachamim, so you can begin to get the answer as to where its place is. It represents an extreme, shall we say, an extreme expression of kindness as opposed to something milder. So it's the strength within the word Kael, which is then now plugged in, so to speak, to the midah of Rachamim, leading to extreme Rachamim, or extreme kindness. But we should know that for this reason, the name Kael can also mean Midas Hadin, because the attribute of judgment, because if Kael just means strong, so depending on context, it can either be strong kindness or strong judgment. And indeed, the name Kael does also have a connotation in context of Midas Hadin. We find this in an interesting place, certainly in Chazal. The Gemara states that the 18 brachos of Shemona Esrei, this is in the fourth parak of brachos, the 18 brachos of Shemona Esrei, they correspond to a number of 18s. And one of the list of 18s that they correspond to are the Shemus of Hashem in Tehillim Kaftes, which is Havel Hashem b'nei Elim, Havel Hashem Kavod V'Oz. There are 18 mentions of Hashem's name. But then, as we know, there are no longer 18 brachos. More correctly, there are no longer just 18 brachos in the Shemona Esrei. There are 19. And therefore, all the places that the Gemara originally drew parallels, that the 18 brachos are connected, those 18, you've got to go back and find the 19th. And within this perek of Tehillim, I mean, you're not going to find more than 18 Shem Hashems. So but there's a final bracha, V'la malshinim al tikva. So what does that correspond to? You're out of Shem Hashems. As the Gemara, it corresponds to another name of Hashem. It's not the name of Yud Kei Vav Kei, but it's another name in there, namely Kael HaKavod Hirim. Kael Hashem Lamayim, Kael HaKavod Hirim. Kael, number 19. But isn't it interesting that the name which is paralleled to the bracha, which is the most midas hadin in the entire Shemona Esrei, because it is calling for the destruction and downfall of the wicked, corresponds to the name Kael, which is meant to be a name of of kindness. And the simple understanding of what the Gemara is saying is that there Kael doesn't mean kindness. It means justice. It is in fact, very extreme justice, which is required for those individuals. And thus you see that the name Kael, it means extreme, and therefore whatever context it is, either extreme kindness or even extreme din. The only way that one could understand that Kael is actually a name of Rachamim, even in that bracha, is actually based on the approach of the Maharal in the Sefer Be'er HaGola to the bracha of Olam HaShinim, which I don't know how many people agree with him, although he's the Maharal, so I don't know how many people he needs to agree with him. But his understanding is that the bracha of Olam HaShinim is all about the rehabilitation of all of those people, which is a very big chiddush. As if to say, Al Titikva, there should be no hope, meaning they should give up hope of being Olam HaShinim and come back and be tzaddikim, and so on and so forth. That's extreme chesed, if that can be brought about. Just the final item that I'd like to mention also relates to Yud Gimel Midah Sharachamim, is at the end in Pasuk Zayin. We see Notzach Chesed Alafim, the Se'av Nefesh V'Chata V'Nakei. Now, as we know, it's a very different reading if you're reading from the Siddur and the Yud Gimel Midah than if you're reading from the Chumash. Because if you read the Yud Gimel Midas from the Siddur, you end with the word Venake, and that's that. But if you look in the Chumash, you will find that Venake lo yinake, which is rather quite different, because that sounds like Hashem will not cleanse, and it sounds like he absolutely will not cleanse, which does not sound like a Midah Rachamim at all. And you have a conflict now, because it's obviously a Midah of Rachamim, because it's in the list of Yud Gimel Midas of Rachamim. So what does it mean? And the Gemara puts them apart, because the Gemara says, sees them as two almost like conflicting things. Vinakeh means Hashem will cleanse the sin. Lo yinakeh means he won't. So will he or won't he? Says the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Lezer HaGadol, it depends if you do tshuva or not. If you do tshuva, then vinakeh. If not, lo yinakeh. Interestingly, Unculus actually writes that into his Targum. Unculus says, Hashem, translating from him into English, Hashem forgives those who return to Torah, and for those who don't return, so he doesn't award them merit. Mean he put the formula of tshuva as a resolution of these two terms. Unculus was a Talmud of Rabbi Eliezer, as the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah and Daf Gimel. Sometimes you can see the shitta of Rabbi Eliezer come out in the Targum Unculus. Here's one of those times. In any case, so that's the resolution. Benakeh lo yinakeh means with tshuva. So obviously, on when we say the Yud Gimel Midas of Rachamim, we focus on the yes. But you've got to know, it depends on tshuva. There is an altogether different dimension into this discussion, which is found in the writings of the Bnei Yisachar, one of the Hasidic greats. And he refers us to a concept that can be traced back to numerous places, the Rambam Ipano, and the Maggid of Mezrich, and the Rokeach. There is a concept called Shloshesrei Midos, 13 Midos. 13 Midos of what? Well, it really depends where you are. If you're in Parshas Kisisa, there's the 13 Midos Sherachamim. If you're just before Psukei Dezimra in the morning, they are the 13 Midos Shatara Nidreshes Vahem. Sometimes they don't always make it, depending. My father Zatzal used to say, if a person comes late for shul, the first thing that gets sacrificed are their korbanos. But they are there, and those are the Shloshesrei Midos. And these Mefarshim explain that there is actually a parallel between these two sets of 13 midos. Namely, we know generally that if a person is involved in Torah, it brings about more rachamim in the world. But specifically, depending on the way that he is darshaning Torah, that will ignite or activate a corresponding midah of rachamim. Very interesting, because now if you look at them, you ask, well, what's the midah of rachamim here, and where do we see this? The first, the first of the midos, according to the Baalei Kabbalah, the Arizal, the Gaon, and others, it really starts with kale. And then Parshas Balosacha, we find that Miriam, so she had saras, and then Moshe davens for her, kale no rafon Allah, and then Hashem healed her. It took 7 days, but He healed her. And how does that come out? So Hashem said, if her father had spat in her face, that means that if her father had shamed her, she would be ashamed for 7 days. So how long will she stay mitzora for? 7 days. And what's the meaning? The meaning is, says, as Rashi explains, it's from the Gemara in Baba Kama in the second parish, it's a kal v'chomer. As if to say, if her father had shamed her, it would be for 7 days, so I'm shaming her, so for sure it's going to be for 7 days. No more. Because dayo labam min hadin, kavachomer doesn't mean more, but it certainly means all the more so. So if it would have been 7 days, so then certainly 7 days. And the answer is 7 days. So what's fascinating about this whole situation is all Moshe wants is for Miriam to get better. Explanations and pilpulim and shir klalis and the discourses, they're very interesting, but the priority here is to heal Miriam. It's very interesting in saying that how long she's going to stay with Taraz for, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does it in such an excursive way. But the point is, says the Maggid, that's how Miriam was healed. Because Moshe Davin's Kael na Rafanana. Kael is the first of the Midos. And Kael means strong. And that's why he said Kael. He appealed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with the Midah of Kael, because someone who's sick needs strength. And therefore he says, ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through the Midah of Kael, heal her and strengthen her. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, I will. And here's how. Through a Kal V'chomer. Because a Kal V'chomer is what is the first of the 13 Midahs Shatorah Nedreshes Bahen. And that's how Miriam, that's how she was cured, through a Kal V'chomer. Because the Midah number one of Shatorah Nedreshes Bahen activated Midah number one of Midah Sherachamim. And thus was Miriam cured. It's an unusual situation. That's the first of the Midos. And now, let's find the last of the Midos. You know, there is a... what's the final Midah for Rabbi Shmuel? Two psukim that conflict with each other. So the third pasuk comes, arbiters between them. Now, okay. What's midah number 13 in the Yud Gimel Midas? Vinake lo yinake. He will cleanse, he won't cleanse. What is that? That's shnik suvim hamakrishin zeze. That's two psukim, they're in contact with each other. All we need now is a kosav ashlishi sheyakriya b'nehem. Is a third pasuk to come and arbiter between them. But we have no more psukim because it's just vinake and lo yinake. And that's all you have, the conflict. May Ayin of Oezri, where's the resolution going to come from? Is there a Kosav of Ashlishi? There is a Kosav of Ashlishi. Because there is a parallel 13 Yud Midas Sharachamim, Yud Gimodas Sharachamim, which is to be found in the Navi. You find it in Tashlich, because the Psukim that we say, Mikael Kamocha, Nosi Avon, Va'over Alpesha, Lishay Risnach Laso, Titin Emes Liakov, Chesed Avram, Eshe Nishpatu Levesenim Mimekede. If you look at all the Machzorim, and it's based on the Zohar, you'll see the Yud Gimel Midrash Rachamim, Hashem Hashem Karachim Achanim, and all of that, printed in small print on top of those words, because it shows you which Psukim in our Parsha correspond to which Psukim there. And the words that correspond to Vinake is the words Mimekedem. Titin Emes Liakov, Chesed Avram, Hashem Nishpat Alev Aseinu, Mimekedem. Those final words Mimekedem, on top of them are the words Vinake. And why? Because the words Mimekedem, from time immemorial, from time primordial, pre-primordial, they're the Kosav Ashlishi. They're what will help resolve. Because the Gemara tells us that one of the things that was created before the world was tshuva. So Gemara Pesachim, the fourth parak. And therefore, Mimekedem refers to tshuva that preceded the world. But tshuva is actually what resolves the contradiction between Benake and Loyinake. With tshuva, Benake. With not, Loyinake. And that's the cost of Ashlishi. And thus we find that the final of the Yud Gimel Midah Sharachamim is Shnei Ksuvim HaMachishin Zetzeh. So we see from many different points of view, from basic pshat parshanut, all the way down to these other levels. And as we know, the Torah transmits on many wavelengths. Plenty to think about. We'll leave it over there.